This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for January 2009. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we highlight a few poems in the upcoming issue. This month, we're going to hear from Kim Adonizio.
For I am a poet, and it is my job, my duty, to know wherein lies the beauty of this degraded body.
And from a very young poet, Alan Edwin Butt.
Words without much use now, unable to remake the thing. And I thought, what should I think?
We're also going to hear from Poetry Magazine readers in a Houston retirement community who wrote us a letter of complaint.
We didn't know why, of all the poems in the world, you would pick this one.
We've packed a lot of poetry and prose into the January issue. Let's start with the prose, maybe, Don.
Sure. A podcast or two ago, we talked about excerpts of the letters between Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop, and we ran some in the magazine. And the book of them, Words in Air, the complete correspondence between Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell, has since come out, and it's been getting a lot of attention.
Our reviewer is Michael Hoffman, and we're a little bit late to the game here, purposefully. Don and I both have been reviews all over the place, and when you get a book like this, it's hard to know exactly what to do with it because you know everybody's going to review it, and you want to do something different, and we wanted to have a poet take a good, close look at it, right, and get inside of it.
Yeah, and I think this isn't just a book review, and it isn't just an essay. It's really a piece all by itself with its own rhythms and excitement. Michael Hoffman's a terrific writer.
He writes at the level of his subjects here, right? Some of these distinctions that he makes about Lowell and Bishop, they're as good as the writing that he quotes. You know, he quotes her at one point saying, she's in Boston in Lowell's hometown, and his point is that Lowell tends to miss things. He tends to just, you know, sort of pound his way through life, whereas she is a butterfly and flitters around and sees all these kinds of things that you wouldn't notice. And so she's in Boston, which is Lowell City, and she says, "It is nice autumn weather. The ivy turns bright colors, but the tree's just an unpleasant yellow. On the library steps, I realized the whole place smelt exactly like a cold, opened, and slightly rotten watermelon." It's perfect. That's a perfect description by Bishop. But listen to what Hoffman does with this. "It is hard not to contrast this gift to him of his own place with his hard, raptor-like, plaid golfing slack announcement. We would like to come and see you, and then rapidly a little more of South America."
And then when he quotes some of Lowell's letters, and you get that sense of Lowell's oracular importance to himself and his being so much a part of what's going on everywhere. He's talking about Delmore Schwartz, remembering the late poet Delmore Schwartz, and Lowell says, "Delmore's voice, almost inaudible, dead, intuitive, pointing somewhere, then the strings tightening, the roar of rage, too much for us." And Hoffman says, "This is hammer work, a hammer on the piano or a hammer on the drums. Bishop makes writing seem like breathing."
That's a perfect description. It's interesting that Hoffman comes down on Lowell so hard because he has been an inheritor of Lowell. You can certainly hear Lowell in a lot of his early poems. And he's such a devotee of Lowell. At one point, he actually indicts Lowell for being a kind of unicorn. You know, he says there are two kinds of poets, and what we want is a poet who has some hinterland. He says that's an ugly Tory word. Some hinterland, basically, of prose, to have experiences, to hold opinions, to store memories, to lead a rich and varied life of the senses. The other type of poet is a unicorn who lives in an ivory tower. He's frightening and different and real, and we don't get him. When Lowell spends an evening reading poems aloud with I.A. Richards, that feels like unicorn behavior to me.
What Hoffman says is that they actually had a kind of antagonism going between them because they were so different. They were contraries. He says each enshrined the other. Short of enmity, it was all they could do.
That's how the piece ends.
Yeah.
We also have three poems by Langston Hughes, which came to us in a kind of roundabout way, right, Don?
Yes, they were discovered by a rare book cataloger at the Beinecke Library at Yale University, and that's where Langston Hughes' papers are. And among other things they have there, they have a bunch of Langston Hughes' personal books, the books in his own library. That's part of his archive. And they've gone through to catalog these books, and they discovered that in one of the last books that did get cataloged, there were these poems written inside the books, little drafts of things. And so we have facsimiles of these up on the website that you can take a look at. But we put the poems together with an introduction by his biographer and editor, Arnold Rampersad.
And Rampersad says something that I think is true, that these aren't going to change your view of Langston Hughes. They're simple poems, and they're They're a little bit like looking into the furnace where more finished things were forged. There's a kind of straightforward rage in these poems. The opening poem is called You and Your Whole Race, and it starts, "You and your whole race look down upon the town in which you live and be ashamed. Look down upon white folks and upon yourselves and be ashamed that such supine poverty exists there." Interesting that the poem is not simply an indictment of the white race, but the black race as well. He's doing both at the same time.
Well, Rampersad says that Hughes saw these poems and poems like them that he did publish partly as a kind of propaganda, but also as what Rampersad calls necessary acts of the committed poet. He says, as a black writer facing racism on a daily basis, he had a remarkably precise sense of scale, as well as an inspired knowledge of the words and rhythms of speech that would best convey his messages to blacks and whites alike. And that poem that you were reading from, You and Your Whole Race, ends, "I dare you to come one step nearer, evil world, with your hands of greed seeking to touch my throat. I dare you to come one step nearer me. When you can say that, you will be free."
We also have poems by some living, breathing poets this month, as every month, including three poems by the well-known poet C.K. Williams. We have poems by a fisheries scientist, Peter Monroe.
We also have some new work by Roddy Lumsden, who's been in the magazine a couple times recently. People are very fond of his work. And a poem by Ann Winters. And also some new poems by Wendy Vidalock.
And these are short poems. All of her poems tend to be short. They're little epigrams, at least one of them. A word on verbs is a little epigram. "It's often those who talk a streak on world affairs and love and peace who seem to love and peace the least." That's the whole poem right there.
It's so short, I'll read one of the other ones, too, about an owl. "The owl, beneath her nest, a shrew's head, a finch's beak, and the bones of a quail attest. The owl devours the hour and disregards the rest." Which sounds a little bit like that Simon and Garfunkel song, "The Boxer."
Oh, right, yeah. Alan Edwin Butt appears for the first time in the magazine, and it's also his very first time in print. We're always delighted to get someone for their first time in print. And Alan is quite young. He's still a student at Presbyterian College in South Carolina, in fact.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I have some folks down in South Carolina, and I was riding around with them to Greenville. It's got some galleries and nice shops and beautiful riverfront restaurants, things like that. Really interesting place. And they also have a school for the arts down there. And when I came back, we were looking through the submissions that we have, and I noticed that there were some poems by a young poet who's from the place I'd just come from. And this was Alan Butt. And so we looked at his poems, and they were extremely interesting.
He's got two poems in the January issue. One is called La Petite Vie, and the one we're going to hear is called Feather in Bas Relief. If those titles remind you of a great modernist American poet with a penchant for French
penchant
things, that's right, yeah, then you're on the right track.
I'm a big fan of Wallace Stevens, and I was thinking sort of those poems that seem to take place sort of outside of time and space.
Here's Alan Edwin Butt reading Feather in Bas Relief.
"Words without much use now, unable to remake the thing. And I thought, what should I think? Followed by spring light looks like feathers. Birds seemed conveniently decorous. What then does this leave, I asked, and was surprised to know so quickly that my understanding of what the light and birds could not be made to mean would not detract from them as they were. Bound by feathers, a thought, I will admit, born of artifice alone, they bore themselves aloft. What could I counter with? I, who held my heart in offering, as much for show as for a fear so deep I found I couldn't name it."
Boy, I could not have written a poem like that when I was in college.
Oh, me either.
You can hear the Stevens. He's assimilated Stevens without it seeming too overbearing in the poem.
It's got a kind of energy to it that Stevens doesn't want necessarily to have, too, so that the lines and stanzas are very concise here and I think very sharp.
Also the emotion at the end, "I who held my heart in offering, as much for show as for a fear so deep I found I couldn't name it."
The poem begins and ends with this kind of thought, you know, "and I thought, what should I think?" It's kind of a questioning, and it's a yearning, but the lines are very clean. You know, it just has a sense of what do I do when I'm walking around in the world? What am I supposed to do? What am I bound by? It's a sense that you want to kind of take off. You want to be flying in and participating in the world with all your energy. And you can see that the poem wants to do that too, but it's constricted in some way. It's bound.
Bound by feathers, a thought, I will admit, born of artifice alone. They bore themselves aloft.
It's a funny thing to say, bound by feathers, because you think of feathers as being something relating to full flight. And when you're bound by them, or if the feather is in bas-relief, it's kind of constricted because there's an artifice. There's some kind of convention that holds it in, holds everyone in place.
Kim Adonizio's fifth poetry collection, Lucifer at the Starlight, will be published by Norton in 2009. Her poem in the January issue is called The First Line is the Deepest.
It's a poem that plays with some famous first lines.
I really wanted to spin the Gerard Manley Hopkins line, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. And I really wanted to spin that to the world is charged with the madness of God. And then a few others occurred to me, and I decided to start putting them together.
In addition to Gerard Manley Hopkins, the poem plays with famous lines by Anne Sexton, Philip Larkin, Dorothy Parker, T.S. Eliot, and others.
It even manages to squeeze in the theme song to the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, it does, and it begins with a nod to Robert Frost's line, a very famous line, I have been one acquainted with the night. Here's Kim Adonizio reading the first line is the deepest.
I have been one acquainted with the spatula, the slotted, scuffed, Teflon-coated spatula that lifts a solitary hamburger from pan to plate, acquainted with the vibrator known as the pocket rocket and the dildo that goes by Tex, and I have gone out a drunken bitch in order to ruin what love I was given, and also I have measured out my life in little pills, Zoloft, Restoril, Celexa, Xanax. I have... For I am a poet, and it is my job, my duty, to know wherein lies the beauty of this degraded body. Or maybe it's the degradation in the beautiful body, the ugly me groping back to my desk to piss on perfection, to lay my kiss of mortal confusion upon the mouth of infinite wisdom. My kiss says razors and pain. My kiss says America is charged with the madness of God. Sundays, too, the soldiers get up early and put on their fatigues in the blue-black day. Black milk, black gold, Texas tea. Into the valley of Halliburton rides the infantry. Why does one month have to be the cruelest? Can't they all be equally cruel? I have seen the best gamers of your generation joysticking their M1 tanks through the sewage-filled streets. Whose world this is, I think I know.
Well, maybe that's the confessional poem to end all confessional poetry.
Yeah,
it seems to run the gamut from Tennyson all the way to Ginsberg. And,
yeah, I love
everything
the way
in between.
It starts out as a, you know, you think it's an ordinary confessional poem, and... I love the way this poem moves from I have been one acquainted with the spatula and talking about being a drunken bitch and her dildo and her pills to something very serious. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we get to, you know, we start out with Frost, we move to these poets, we get Dorothy Parker, we end with Paul Celan here. You know, black milk in the morning, I drink you and I drink you. And that then morphs into the Beverly Hillbillies. It's really brilliant. You know, she's bringing in all these things and it ends with this image of war.
Yeah.
The effect of it is, you know, that it could be a kind of self-aggrandizing or self-pitying poem. In effect, what she does here at the end is she manages to implicate herself into what's going on at the end of this poem, into the last image. Her solitariness and kind of solipsism that she talks mm-hmm. about early on.
Self-absorption
becomes the energy at the end of this poem.
Well, there's a modest triumph in this, starting out being depressed and taking these medications and feeling, you know, that her own individual body and its beauty has been damaged, causes her to reflect on not just how to write about that and leaving it there, but to say that if she's a poet, she has a job and her duty is to know about the degradation of the body. And when you start thinking about it, it's not just what happens to ourselves, it's what happens to other people. And in the war, many bodies are mutilated. And it's a much larger picture, so she backs off of her own preoccupations and starts to look at the preoccupations of our culture, our Anglo-American culture, which involves not just poetry, but of course, war.
And that rescues the poem really from being simple pastiche.
Yeah.
It works at that level. It's very funny.
Why does one month have to be the cruelest? Can't they all be equally cruel?
It's funny, and yet it's also, I think, very deeply serious, because instead of talking about the cruelty that makes one feel filled with self-pity, the cruelty here is month to month to month, the news, the war. What happens to the best people of our generation, our young people? They play games and or go to war. And then the end of the poem, whose world this is, I think I know. It's a kind of knowledge, a self-knowledge that isn't psychological or psychiatric.
Yeah.
It's real knowledge.
And we end with frost again.
Yeah.
His woods, these are, I think I know.
Yeah.
In the back of the January issue, you'll find a short letter from Alice Pillsbury, who is the activities director of the Tremont Retirement Community in Houston, Texas. She wrote us on behalf of a poetry study group that they have there at the Tremont Retirement Community, where she has joined us by phone. Alice, rather than having us explain your letter, would you mind just letting us know what was in it again?
Well, basically, the study group has studied for 4 years every week a variety of poetry, including college-level poetry textbooks and the best poems of the English language and Garrison Keillor's collections. And so we went ahead and subscribed to Poetry Magazine, thinking that that would be the next step for us. But we found that the poems did not appeal to us. They didn't communicate ideas or pictures through either words or structure that really made any sense to us. We found that the language was often very obtuse. The words are used that we don't even know what they're talking about, and we're very knowledgeable people. And a lot of the poems just seemed to be a jumble of words and phrases that had no relation to each other, so that the poem didn't make any sense to us. So we were very disappointed. We found really very little that we could relate to.
So we sent the group the January issue in advance to see how they responded to that, and we were going to talk a little bit about that. Alice, how did people respond to the January? Did we do any better, or the same?
Well, actually, we found that if we read the poem two or three times, the ones that we thought made no sense at all sometimes developed a certain rhythm pattern and did make some sense. And we did find four poems that we did like and some that we really thoroughly disliked.
What did you think about the Kim Adonizio poem? Don and I were talking earlier about the Adonizio poem. I know you didn't hear it. But what did you think about the first line is the deepest?
They didn't like it. They thought there was no need for the language to be so vulgar, in their words. They wondered why you would want to publish in a national publication something like this of her personal experience. We could see where she has every right to write it and express it, but we didn't know why, of all the poems in the world, you would pick this one. Also, we couldn't figure out what the point of the poem was. Obviously, we didn't like the structure because the first sentence is half of the page and the second sentence is almost the rest of the poem. But we couldn't figure out this joy sticking the M1 tanks in the sewage-filled streets, and then she has, to us, the audacity to virtually quote a line from Robert Frost, Stopping by the Woods.
When we were talking about the poem a few minutes ago, we were describing all the different poets whose work gets into this, everything from Tennyson to Allen Ginsberg, of course, the Frost that you noticed. And what emerges is it's a kind of pastiche of lines of poems that everybody knows and everybody learns. And I guess the idea behind the poem and what was interesting to us was taking all of the kind of background of poetry that's in our heads and making it somehow pertinent to the way people talk now and to current events like the war and some of the scandals and other things in the news. And so we thought she was trying to put this together. And obviously it's kind of a glib poem at the beginning, but I think it ends up with the Frost on a very respectful note. I have the idea that maybe, you know, she wouldn't disagree with some of the things that you felt about it. It's a sort of a protesty poem, you know?
Oh, it definitely was. Well, I would be interested, I guess, in hearing from the podcast interview with her just exactly what poets she's quoting, because we've read 4 years of poetry, and we certainly didn't see anything about razors and pain and piss and all that in any of the poets that we've read. So we missed the point entirely on that.
Well, the razors and pain is Dorothy Parker, and you've got the frost. Let's see, who else do we have?
Well, there's the Hopkins, The World is Charged with the Grandeur of God.
There's Ginsberg, I Have Seen the Best Minds of My Generation, which she makes I Have Seen the Best Gamers of Your Generation.
Oh, I see. She sort of takes the thought and changes the words.
Yeah, right, changes it slightly.
But now we understand you liked the Alan Edwin Butt poem a little better.
Yeah, The Feathers in Bas Relief, yes, we like that a little better, but one of our questions there is, why did they bother to write it in a three-line verse form with these enormously long sentences that wrap around and around and around? Why don't they just write sentences?
That's an interesting
question.
That's
a great question.
Yeah, I it's funny, Yeats says that late in his life that he only revised toward a more passionate syntax. And if you look at early Yeats, W.B. Yeats, the poems do play out sentence by sentence. If you look at later Yeats, they begin to become these broken, twisted bits of metal going around the lines and difficult to follow sometimes. I think what this poem is trying to do is to work out with its form, its subject. It's trying to get at something, an emotional tone, an emotional feeling in the poem that's hard to get at. And at the end, it says, who held my heart in offering as much for show as for a fear so deep I found I couldn't name it.
Yes, we liked that verse. And we liked all three of the poems by Wendy Vidlock.
Mm. Uh-huh. Yeah, we talked about that. I like that little epigram, who seemed to love and peace the least.
Yeah, we liked all of hers. We read them. We read them several times. They made sense to us, and they gave us something to think about. Also, The Stray Dogs in Fall. Now, that was interesting because we could relate to it, but we felt that he had a deeper meaning in that poem. It wasn't just as obvious as it appeared.
You mentioned that you read all the poems aloud. I know when I'm reading poems, any poems at all, and also when I'm writing poems, I do it all aloud. And when we expect, one of the things we're looking for is simply the way that the language sounds. The kind of shape that it makes in the air. We read these things dozens of times. A lot of times, I think a poem might not mean the first time through. You might not be able to figure out exactly what it means, but the sound alone can carry you along for a while. Right, Don?
Yeah. One of the challenges, which is a fun challenge for us, and I'm sure you guys too, as readers of poems, is to try to see what our tastes are, what we like, what we don't like, what we object to, what carries deep meaning for us. And you kind of don't know that until you work with a poem for a while and let it sort of unravel itself in front of your eyes and you hear its cadences and rhythms. And one of the things behind the magazine, of course, is that it's perfectly okay for people to reject or object to poems in the magazine because we're presenting a variety of things, and you never know. It seems to me if you find one or two or three poems anywhere in the world that mean something to you, then you can ignore the ones that you don't think so much of. So we were really hoping that you guys would find something you'd like there.
We did. We did. We also wonder why there's so little humor.
That's Don. It's all Don.
Perhaps you think that humor is too glib or too light.
No, and I actually think the Wendy Vidlock poems that you liked are kind of funny and witty. I think, though, too, that for a lot of poets who feel that poetry isn't paid attention to and taken seriously in our culture, I think they're trying to find out what their role is as artists and writers and citizens. And they're taking on some very serious things. Obviously, the war that's going on, and, there's a sense that being a writer or an artist or an intellectual is privileged, and yet these are people who are keenly conscious of, social problems. And that makes people in their writing sound pretty glum, I think, when they take stock of what it is they want to write about. But I'm not pushing that argument on you.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason why these poems sound the way they do. But it's not because we steer away from or toward anything in particular. It's kind of what's out there, I guess.
Well, good. I'm so glad that you took notice of our letter. We're very thrilled that we had a chance to express our feelings and really appreciate your getting back with us and giving us a fair shot at discussing the poems.
Well, it's great talking to you, Alice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Alice Pillsbury is the Activities Director of the Tremont Retirement Community in Houston. You can read everything you heard on this program in the January issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program and the magazine. Maybe we'll get to talk to you next. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
We got recording help this month from Scott Johnson at ETV in Beaufort, South Carolina, and John Rieger in Berkeley. The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded and edited by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.